Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Ex Post Facto Sentencing Guidelines Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 26, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Pew v. United States. The question in this case is whether a court violates the Constitution's prohibition on ex post facto laws by using the U.S. sentencing guidelines in effect at the time of the defendant's sentencing rather than those in effect at the time of the underlying offense, when the newer guidelines create a significant risk that the defendant will receive a longer sentence. To discuss the case, we have Carissa Byrne-Hessick, who is a professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Hessick.
Hi, this is Carissa Byrne-Hessick, and I'm going to talk to you today about Pew versus United States, a case that was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on February 22, 2012, and at the time of this recording, it has not yet been decided. Pew is a very interesting case. It's interesting as a possible vehicle for changing ex post facto jurisprudence or as a possible vehicle for changing federal sentencing law. At this point, I think that the outcome of the case is difficult to predict based on the questions that were asked at oral argument. Only a few justices asked questions that indicated their leaning one way or another. But before I start talking about Pew specifically, to understand the issues presented by Pew, it's first necessary to give some background information about the ex post facto clause and about some recent changes to federal sentencing law. So let's start with the ex post facto clause. The prohibition on ex post facto laws is an interesting feature of American constitutional law. The Constitution contains two ex post facto clauses, one prohibiting the Congress from enacting ex post facto laws, and the second prohibiting the states from enacting such laws. The definitive case on the ex post facto clause is Calder v. Bull, a 1798 U.S. Supreme Court case. That case held that the clause applies only to criminal laws. It does not prevent the enactment of so-called retroactive civil laws. Interestingly, there's a rich body of scholarship from the first half of the 20th century demonstrating that this narrow view of the clause is almost certainly at odds with the intent of the framers, who discussed the inclusion of the clause almost entirely in terms of whether legislatures could pass laws that would retroactively affect the value of Revolutionary-era currency. Despite this scholarship, current doctrine applies the clause only to criminal laws. In other words, originalism has not triumphed with respect to this clause of the Constitution. So instead of looking to the intent of the framers, current doctrine uses Calder v. Bull as the starting point for ex post facto questions. That opinion defines the scope of the ex post facto clauses to prohibit four categories of law. First, every law that makes an action done before the passing of the law and which was innocent when done, criminal, and punishes such action. Second, every law that aggravates a crime or makes it greater than it was when committed. Third, every law that changes the punishment and inflicts a greater punishment than the law annexed to the crime when committed. And fourth, every law that alters the legal rules of evidence and receives less or different testimony than the law required at the time of the commission of the offense in order to convict the offender. This case, Pew, raises a question under the third Calder category, namely whether a change to the federal sentencing guidelines, which increases sentencing ranges, is a change that, quote, changes punishment and inflicts greater punishment than the law annexed to the crime when committed. So cases subsequent to Calder have further refined these Calder categories, with the Supreme Court explicitly acknowledging that the meaning of the ex post facto clause is the product of the accretion of its own common law. Recent cases, such as California Department of Corrections versus Morales, which was decided in 1995, have framed the test for whether a law impermissibly increases punishment above the level set at the time a crime has been committed as whether the law, quote, produces a sufficient risk of increasing the measure of punishment attached to the covered crime, close quote. That question is, as the court explains, necessarily, quote, a matter of degree. And as the court explained in Morales, it has never devised a single formula for identifying those legislative changes that have a sufficient effect on substantive crimes or punishment to fall within the constitutional prohibition. In Garner versus Jones, which was decided in the year 2000, the court restated the test as whether the change in law, quote, creates a significant risk of prolonging the defendant's incarceration, close quote. In 1987, the Supreme Court decided a case involving the retroactive application of new sentencing guidelines that increased a sentencing range. That case, Miller versus Florida, involved a state sentencing guideline regime that severely restricted the discretion of judges when imposing sentence. Following that decision, every federal circuit held that the retroactive application of amendments to the federal sentencing guidelines, which increased sentences above the sentence in place at the time was committed, also violated the ex post facto clause. No circuit disagreed. So you might be asking, why is the Pew case before the Supreme Court if all of the federal circuits agree? Well, the answer lies in how the federal sentencing system has changed over the past decade. In 2005, the Supreme Court changed the federal system from a mandatory sentencing system to an advisory sentencing system in a case called United States versus Booker. A little bit of Booker background. The decision in Booker was based on the court's 2000 opinion in Apprendi versus New Jersey. Apprendi involved a legislative sentencing enhancement, which provided for an increase in the statutory maximum sentence from 10 to 20 years in prison for the unlawful possession of a firearm if the sentencing judge found that the defendant possessed that firearm to intimidate someone because of his or her race. The Apprendi court held that such a statutory sentencing enhancement violated the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, reasoning that other than the fact of a prior conviction, any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Relying on this principle from Apprendi, the Booker court explained that to the extent that the guideline system allowed judges to make factual findings that resulted in sentencing ranges far above those authorized solely by the jury's verdict, the mandatory guideline system was unconstitutional. It was basically indistinguishable, they said, from sentencing enhancements created by legislatures. So, the Sixth Amendment problem with a mandatory sentencing guideline system was that it allowed judges to make factual findings by a preponderance of the evidence instead of requiring juries to make those findings beyond a reasonable doubt. An obvious way to have remedied this constitutional problem was for the court to have required facts that result in a higher guideline range by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But the court chose not to require sentencing juries, even though four justices would have preferred that remedy. Five justices joined a remedial opinion that instead severed the statutory provision which made the guidelines mandatory, a provision of the Sentencing Reform Act of 1983 that created the U.S. Sentencing Commission and the whole guideline system. By severing this statutory provision that made the guidelines mandatory, the Booker court rendered the guidelines advisory. And the court reasoned that if the guidelines weren't mandatory, then they didn't fall within the rule established by Apprendi. Now, you might be asking yourself, why does the mandatory or advisory nature of a sentencing guideline system affect its status under the ex post facto clause? Well, there's a textual argument. That argument is that the Constitution forbids the enactment of ex post facto laws, and while mandatory guidelines have the force and effect of legislation, advisory guidelines don't. There's also a doctrinal argument, namely that while a change in mandatory guidelines will have a certain effect on the length of a defendant's punishment, a change in an advisory guideline system may not. Put differently, if the judge has to follow the guidelines, then changing the guidelines will necessarily change the sentence a judge imposes. But if a judge is free to disregard the guidelines, then changing the guidelines is no different than any other number of changed circumstances that could potentially result in a longer sentence for a defendant. In other words, allowing advisory guidelines to trigger the ex post facto clause could result in a large expansion of the application of the clause. And that's, in effect, the argument that the government's advancing in Pew. I should note that a variation on this government proved convincing to the court in Irizarry to say that whatever rule it had established for notice to a defendant prior to a sentencing hearing changed with the Booker opinion. So the court's already acknowledged that the change from the mandatory system to the advisory system under Booker may affect some other rights that defendants have. Okay, but the ex post facto clause issue is complicated by some unresolved issues in federal sentencing doctrine. As I mentioned before, the Booker opinion changed the federal sentencing guidelines so that those guidelines are now advisory rather than mandatory. But there's still significant disagreement, both among the circuits and, based on some exchanges during the oral argument in Pew, among the justices themselves, about precisely how much sentencing freedom federal district courts have in the wake of Booker. While Booker said that district courts were no longer obliged to impose guideline sentences, it still requires the trial courts to calculate the sentencing range under the guidelines and to consider that range as one of several factors in imposing sentence. Booker also explicitly retained some appellate review features of the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. Prior to the enactment of the guidelines, federal criminal sentences were, in most circumstances, unreviewable on appeal, and the Sentencing Reform Act changed that, providing for appellate review that, by design, resulted in few sentences that did not strictly adhere to the federal sentencing guidelines. So the Booker Court retained appellate review, although it decreased the level of appellate scrutiny, and the Booker opinion, written by Justice Breyer, said that it expected appellate review would promote uniformity in sentencing. In other words, while the district courts were free to sentence outside the guidelines, the appellate courts would police that exercise of discretion. The justices who dissented from the Booker remedy complained that this would likely result in a functional return to mandatory guidelines because non-guideline sentences would be reversed on appeal. In its sentencing cases after Booker, the Supreme Court has continued to walk this odd tightrope of sentencing discretion at the trial level and fidelity to the guidelines in the appellate level. In previous scholarship that I've written, I've chronicled this odd tension. For example, the court has said that appellate courts may presume that a guidelines sentence is the correct sentence on appeal, but said that trial courts may not make such a presumption when sentencing itself. And as I've argued elsewhere, this is a completely novel, if not nonsensical, use of a legal presumption. The petitioner in Pew relies on this presumption and other features of post-Booker sentencing doctrine in support of his argument that although the guidelines no longer impose binding sentencing ranges, they continue to have the force and effect of law, albeit in a more limited fashion, after the decision in Booker. He also presents significant statistical data demonstrating how influential the guidelines are generally, and guidelines amendments that increase particular sentences in particular are, and how they continue to be influential after Booker. So, to answer the ex post facto question in Pew, the government portrays the guidelines as playing only a minor role in post-Booker sentencing, while the petitioner emphasizes how much influence the guidelines continue to have. The odd thing is, or I guess I should say something that I think is odd, is that both the government and the petitioner are correct in how they've characterized the role of the guidelines. The Supreme Court opinions include conflicting analysis about what role the guidelines are supposed to play at sentencing. In a case called Gall, for example, the Supreme Court overturned a circuit court decision which reviewed decisions to sentence outside the guidelines range based on a proportionality principle, that is, a test that required the amount of a variation from the guidelines to be justified by an extraordinary circumstance identified by the district court. And at the same time, though, in Gall, that it purported to reject proportionality review, the Gall court stated that it was uncontroversial that a major departure should be supported by a more significant justification than a minor one. The Gall court made no effort to resolve the tension between this statement, which encourages substantive appellate review of sentences outside the guideline range, and the court's holding, which suggested that appellate courts should defer to district court determinations. Not only does the analysis in the court's own opinions conflict, but the circuits aren't uniform in how they're reviewing sentencing decisions. Some circuits have seized on language that favors the guidelines, while others have seized on language that emphasizes district court discretion. And the result is that the standard of appellate review for sentencing is not uniform across the country. What the Pew oral argument revealed to me is that this tension between district court freedom and sentencing, which is necessary to avoid Sixth Amendment problems, and the desire to promote guideline sentences through appellate review is not simply the result of poor drafting on the part of the court. Rather, it's a result of real tension on the court itself between the justices. Justice Breyer, in particular, responded negatively to the government's characterization of the guidelines at the oral argument as little more than policy statements. Justice Breyer stated that the court's cases on the matter have left that an open question. So leaves us to conclude that perhaps these conflicting statements in these post-Booker and the Booker opinion itself are there by design because we don't have agreement among the justices. I, of course, have criticized this feature of post-Booker sentencing reform, not only in this podcast, but in articles that I've published, saying that the post-Booker sentencing doctrine is trying to have its cake and eat it too. It insists that district courts are free to use their own judgment in imposing sentence, but at the same time, it is trying to retain a not insignificant role for the guidelines through appellate review. Perhaps Pew will force the court to grapple with the guidelines and the role that they play after Booker. But then again, it may not. The court may instead use Pew as an opportunity to cut back on its test for when a change in law triggers the ex post facto prohibition. Consider the following passage from United States versus Demaree. That's a 2006 Seventh Circuit opinion that led the district court in Pew's case to apply the new harsher guidelines. That opinion says, quote, "The test of an ex post facto law has been variously stated by the Supreme Court as whether it places the defendant at a disadvantage or substantial disadvantage compared to the law as it stood when he committed the crime of which he's been convicted, changed the definition of the crime, or increased the maximum penalty for it, or imposed a significant risk of enhanced punishment. Any of these formulas, interpreted literally, would encompass a change in even voluntary sentencing guidelines, for official guidelines, even if purely advisory, are bound to influence judges' sentencing decisions." This Seventh Circuit opinion, which was written by Judge Posner, went on to describe a number of scenarios that could also create a significant risk of punishment. And thinking that those scenarios ought not trigger the ex post facto clause, Judge Posner seems to have decided upon a more narrow reading of the ex post facto clause, one that advisory guidelines don't run afoul of. And indeed, some of these hypothetical scenarios from Judge Posner's opinion made an appearance in the form of questions at the oral argument in Pew. And in asking these questions, I think Justice Scalia was signaling that he's not sympathetic to an expansive reading of the ex post facto clause. Justices Kagan and Ginsburg, on the other hand, seem more receptive to the petitioner's arguments. And I'll say it's, of course, always dangerous to attempt to predict the outcome based on an oral argument. Here, in particular, a number of justices didn't tip their hands about which side's arguments they found more convincing, though Justice Breyer did indicate, in rather strong terms, that he would be unwilling to join an opinion that destroys completely the status of the federal sentencing guidelines. Though, as I mentioned, it's not clear that that needs to happen for the case to be decided. This case may ultimately end up being decided on very narrow grounds. A number of the court's previous ex post facto cases quite self-consciously said that they were avoiding articulating more broadly applicable principles and simply deciding the case on more narrow fact-specific grounds. And indeed, the government seems to have been pushing for that here, both in their brief and oral argument. They seem to be suggesting that it's possible to simply object to the way that the district court read his obligations under the guidelines here. Perhaps he deferred to them too much. And that then may be a much more narrow ground on which the court could decide this case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.